looking at an index of social problems. And so these problems include, and not just social problems, but health problems, mental illness, crime and violence, such as homicides or imprisonment, obesity, infant mortality, teenage births, as well as low educational performance, low social mobility, and low trust. What they observe is that among high-income countries, countries that have high levels of inequality also have worse health and social problems, right? And so you can see, for example, the USA is among high-income countries, is one of the most unequal high-income countries, and it ranks very highly in terms of health and social problems. So crime and violence, mental illness, I'm sure many of you, obesity, I'm sure many of you have heard about some of these issues there. So that's one of the reasons why people are interested in the relationship between income inequality and health. But then when it comes to the relationship between income inequality and health, a lot of these studies have been ecological studies, like the one that I just showed you. It's looking at overall levels of inequality in a country and comparing that to overall average health within that country, right? But there are two competing explanations for the relationship between income inequality and health. One is that it's what is known as a compositional effect. So essentially, it's just reflecting the composition of the population. So countries that are more unequal, for example, tend to have a lot more poor people in the country, right? So they have a high concentration of poor people. And so maybe the health in the nation overall is worse because there are a lot of poor people, and those who are poor tend to have worse health outcomes, right? So that's one argument, right? And in that argument, it's not really an issue of inequality affecting everyone, but just that those who are poor tend to have worse health, and there are a lot of poor people in unequal countries. However, there's another hypothesis, which is that there's a contextual effect, right? So it's about the context. And so with this hypothesis, the argument is that inequality is harmful to everyone's health, including the rich, right? So for example, if you're a wealthy person who earns a certain level of income and you live in a country with high levels of inequality, your health would be worse than if you had the very same level of income, but were living in a country with less inequality. So that's what the contextual effect argues. And the only way to really study that is by using multi-level studies where you can control for individual's personal income or household income, and then see whether the inequality and the context they live in has any impact on their health. And so that was what I tried to do in this research. So we've talked a lot about inequality, but how do we actually measure it, right? Because one of the difficulties in social epidemiology is that it's hard, very difficult to measure social factors, right? Social phenomena. And so there's many ways that people have used to measure inequality, and I'll just describe one of the popular ones here. So the Gini index or Gini coefficient, which I mentioned a bit earlier, is one of the common measures of inequality. And it's essentially a measure of the extent to which the distribution of incomes is unequal in a society. And so the graph on the right sort of illustrates that. So if you have, say, a society where everybody has the same income, then you have perfect equality, and the Gini coefficient will be zero. So that's this diagonal line here, the 45-degree line here. In that scenario, for each additional person, there's an equal increase in income, right? So it goes up in this kind of constant slope, right? On the opposite end, you have perfect inequality, where in that scenario, everyone in the population will have zero income until you get to the very last person, and then they have all the income, right? So that's the line along the axes here. And so that's given a score of 1 or 100%. Now, most countries lie somewhere in the middle, and so they have a curve that looks like this. And so what the Gini index does is it measures this area, measures how far from the perfect inequality line a country is, what their curve is when you distribute the incomes. And so a higher Gini index means higher inequality. So that's one way of measuring inequality. So So we've discussed inequality, we've discussed links with health and how to measure it. And I just wanted to bring in one other concept, which is social capital. And so social capital, I'm sure many of you have heard of this as well. We usually use it to refer to some of the resources that are accessed by individuals through their social networks and their network connections. And it's also something which is studied a lot in social epidemiology. And there's many different types of social capital. I put two examples here. For example, structural social capital, which is how much people participate in their network. So how active are people in their community, for example? And then there's also cognitive social capital, is how much people trust each other in the community, how much reciprocity there is in the community. And so you can look at these concepts both at an individual level, right? So for example, how much does each person participate in their community, or how much does a person trust the others in their community? But you can also look at it, again, as a contextual measure. So you can look at, on average, how active is a community in terms of their network participation? On average, how much trust is there in that community? And social capital has also been linked to health outcomes. It's also linked to inequality, right? So what we find is that countries that have a lot of inequality have very low social capital. So taking South Africa as an example, and some of the World Value surveys that have been done, as few as 12% of South Africans believe that others can be trusted, right? And I think it's probably seemed a bit obvious that when you have a very unequal society, that levels of trust in others will be quite low. So this trust or cognitive social capital, having more social capital, right, more trust, has been linked to having better mental health, as well as better self-rated health and other health outcomes. So now that we've kind of gotten all those concepts, given that background, I'll present kind of the conceptual model that informed this research. And so here I have these NCD risk factors at the bottom of this chart here. So like cardiovascular disease risk factors, such as blood pressure, BMI, physical inactivity, smoking, alcohol, and also mental health, right, such as depression. And so what the hypothesis was is, you know, income inequality can affect these health outcomes through different pathways, right? So we know that income inequality is linked to social capital, crime, and some of these social issues, right? And those can affect people's health. For example, if you live in a community with high crime and low social capital, you might not be able to go out and do much physical activity, for example, right? In addition, both the inequality and low social capital can affect your levels of stress, right? So psychosocial stress is one of the mechanisms that people believe might link inequality and social capital to health. And so people who are more stressed, that can affect their health outcomes either directly through physiological or biological pathways. So for example, having a lot of stress increases your heart rate, it increases your blood pressure. And if this is a chronic situation, that can lead to increased risk for NCDs, right? It can increase your blood pressure, inflammation, and overweight and obesity and those things. In addition, people who are stressed also tend to adopt unhealthy behaviors, right? So people might eat more, right, as a way of coping with the stress, and that can raise their BMI. Or people might start using substances. They might smoke or drink alcohol, right? And all of those things are linked to NCDs and also to mental health. So that's kind of where this hypothesis linking these concepts together came from. So as kind of mentioned before, a lot of the research on these areas at the time had been done mostly in high-income countries, and also tended to use ecological data, right, where you couldn't really control for what an individual's circumstances are, right? And so a lot of the research had also been cross-sectional, right? So you can't really determine was people's health bad because they had low levels of trust, or did they have low levels of trust because they had poor health, right? So Those were some of the issues in the literature. Also confounding, right? When you compare different people who live in different communities that have different levels of inequality or different levels of social capital, there might be many other things that are different between those individuals or between those communities, and those can be affecting their health. So that can create confounding, which can make it hard to actually tell whether the inequality and the social capital are actually affecting their health. So in the research that I did, I was trying to address some of these gaps in the literature. So I used South Africa as a case study, right? In South Africa, it's a middle-income country that has very high levels of inequality, right? And many of the high-income countries that have been studied tend to have lower levels of inequality. So I wanted to see how do things look in this environment. So I did three analyses, one looking at here using longitudinal panel data, so data following individuals over time. So looking at whether changes in their income inequality in the districts they lived in were associated with changes in their risk factors for CVD in the first analysis, as well as in their depressive symptoms in the second analysis. And in the final analysis, I wanted to look specifically at this issue of trust. So both their personal trust and then the trust in the districts they lived in, whether that was associated with their mental health, right, their depressive symptoms. So those were the analyses I did. And so I'll start by presenting, some of the methods I used. So as I mentioned, I was lucky to have access to a longitudinal panel study, which is called the National Income Dynamics Study. And it's a national study that was conducted in South Africa between 2008 and 2017. And at the time I was doing this research, there were just three waves available. From 2008, then the first wave, 2010 to 11 was the second, and 2012 was the third wave. So in addition to this data set, I also linked these data to data from census sources. And this was really in order to calculate, the income inequality levels in the districts where people live. So in South Africa, in between the census, so the census is conducted every 10 years, similar to how it's done in Ghana. But in between the census, they do a community survey in order to just update the estimates from the census and also get a sense of things of the situation at a subnational level. So they had done a community survey the year before the NIDS study started. And so that included a 2% random sample of the whole population. So I used that to calculate district level characteristics for this analysis. And then they had a census in 2011. And I had access to a 10% sample of the census from Data First. And so I used that. That was conducted the year before the final wave, the wave three of the NIDS. So I used that again to kind of construct these district level variables such as inequality. So this is kind of a graph that's showing that. So at the individual and household level, I had this NIDS survey at two time points. So the wave one survey in 2008, and the wave three survey in 2012. And I linked that, so using the districts people were living in, I linked that to this community survey conducted the previous year to calculate their inequality levels in the district and other district area level characteristics. And then for the second time point, wave three, I used the census, which was also conducted the year before. So that's what that's how I constructed the data for the first two analyses. For the last one about trust, there aren't really any census or sources that have questions about trust and things like that. So I was limited to using the measure that were directly in the NIDS study. So for that, I was able to use all three waves of the study. And I, at the individual level, I got the data from that NIDS survey. And then I aggregated the levels of trust in the districts from the individuals in the districts to make district level data for the three time points. So in terms of the sample, right, because here I wanted to look at change over time. So rather than comparing different individuals to each other, I wanted to compare each individual to themselves at different points in time. So the sample had to include individuals who, for the first two analyses, had to include individuals who were present in both, at both time points, at both waves. So there were about 9,500 people in the survey who are present in both the first wave and the third wave. For the last analysis, because I had I was using three waves of the survey, I included people who were at least present in two waves of the survey, so I can look at their change between at least two time points. And there were about close to 16,000 people in that. So health outcomes that I was interested in, the NCD related outcomes, were CVD risk factors. So this included people's blood pressure, which was measured, their body mass index to give a sense of, you know, overweight and obesity, their waist circumference, again, to also give a sense of their nutritional status, as well as some health behavior. So whether they smoked or not, whether they exercised or not, and then whether they drank large amounts of alcohol or not. And then for the mental health outcomes, I looked at depressive symptoms. So the NIDS survey had a scale known as the Center for Epidemiology Studies of Depression, a short version of that with 10 items. You can see the items on the right, which ask about, like, how often in the past week did you feel fearful? Did you have restless sleep, or did you feel depressed? Things like that. And so I used that to get a sense of depressive symptoms. So higher scores represented the fact that people had worse depressive symptoms. They had more symptoms of depression, and scores of 10 or more were considered to be high levels of depressive symptoms. So those were the NCD-related outcomes that I looked at. And in terms of the exposures, again, income inequality was the main exposure for the first two analyses. And I calculated Gini coefficients at the district level for all 52 districts at the two time points, so 2007 and 2011. And then in the models, I just multiplied it by 10 so that each slope or the coefficient would represent a 10 percentage point change in the Gini coefficient. Then for trust, right, cognitive social capital. So there were two questions in the NIDS survey. And what they did, they presented a scenario to the people in the survey. They said, imagine that you lost your wallet or your purse, and it had 200 rands in it, and it was found by someone who lives close by. So how likely is it that you think that they would return your wallet with the money in it, right? So they asked, is it very likely, somewhat likely, or not likely? And then they presented the same scenario again and asked, well, okay, imagine you lost your wallet. It was found by a complete stranger. How likely do you think it is that they'll return your money with a wallet in it? So it's an interesting way of measuring people's trust. It's maybe not a very common way, but that was what was available in the survey. So what I did for that is that I had, okay, what each individual rated, how likely they felt they would get their money back. And then I aggregated that for each district that they lived in to get the percentage of people who felt that it was very likely they would get their money back compared to those who felt like it was somewhat or not likely. So those were the main measures that were used. And then, of course, there were a number of different covariates that I considered as well to help to control for different factors. So the study design, so what I did in the study was, because it was longitudinal, it was following individuals over time, I used a design known as the fixed effects regression. And I won't go into the details of the model, but just to explain what fixed effects regression does, is it only looks at changes that occur over time. So sometimes it's also referred to as a difference in difference model, right? If there's only two time points, for example. So you're looking at the changes within individuals, right? Changes in their exposure and relating that to changes in their outcome, right? So in this case, what you're doing is you're using each individual as their own control, right? And that helps to control for confounding, right? Because it eliminates all the factors and differences between individuals and between places. And what it does is just look at how do their outcomes change under different levels of exposure. right? So what the fixed effects design does is it automatically controls for everything that remains constant over time. So because you're only modeling the changes, anything that stays constant over time automatically drops out of the model. So you automatically control for everything that's constant over time, including unobserved confounders that might be constant over time. Now, of course, there might be things that change over time, other confounders that change over time. And that's why I included some of those covariates that I mentioned in the previous slide. So those were the methods that were used. So now the interesting part, what did we find? What were the results? So in terms of inequality, so here we have a map of South Africa with each of the D2 districts here, the boundaries here. And so from the 2007 community survey, the 2011 census, what I saw was that overall inequality tended to increase in that 4-year time span, just marginally from an average of 0.73 or 73%, 0.75 or 75%. And you can see that in the graph as well, in the maps, that, you know, there's this lighter shading represents lower levels of inequality, the darker shading is higher levels. And you can see that the shading became a bit darker over that 4-year time span. So just in that time span, you can see that there was a slight increase in inequality. Now, in terms of the individuals in the samples, for the inequality analyses, there were about 2/3 of the people in the sample were female, about 80% of them were Black African, and then 15% were colored, and then smaller proportions of white and Asian Indian South Africans. There was about an equal split of urban and rural, and at baseline, the individuals in the survey were about 39 years old. Now, what I observed in terms of their characteristics over time, their monthly household income increased between the first wave and the third wave. And this is considering inflation. So this is controlling for inflation. So they did seem to have slightly more income over time. But then their risk factors for CVD mostly also increased as well. So, systolic blood pressure went up slightly. Diastolic blood pressure increased from about 82 to 83.5. The body mass index also increased from about 26 to 27. The waist circumferences increased about 4 centimeters within the 4 years. Smoking is the only one where we saw a slight decrease. So from 19.5% of them smoking in the first wave to 19.1% in the third wave. But they became less active, right? So in terms of inactivity, about 72% of them were inactive in the first wave. And third wave, about 74% of them were. And then high alcohol consumption also increased over time. So most of the CVD risk factors were moving in the wrong direction, right? And part of that has to do with aging, right? That as people grow older, their blood pressures tend to go up, their body mass index also tends to go up. In terms of the mental health outcomes, their depressive symptom scores went down between the two waves. So that's a positive thing. So that mean score dropped from about 8.1 to 7.1. And then the percentage of people with high depressive symptoms dropped from about 34% to 27%. So we see there's mixed results in terms of, you know, risk factors for these NCDs. Now, in terms of trust, right? So in the last analysis, one thing that we also observed was that trust tended to get better over time as well. So if you're looking at this this row here, those who were not likely to trust their neighbor, the percentage dropped from about 75% to 71%. And similarly, those who were not likely to trust strangers, the percentage dropped from about 88% to about 79%. So was also a positive finding. Also the perceived health status, those who said they had fair or poor health, that also decreased over the time period. So those are some of the descriptive results. So now were all these changes actually associated with each other? So that's the main question. So in the models, essentially what I found was that the changes in income inequality, the district level income inequality, were not significantly associated with the changes that were observed in people's health outcomes, so CBD risk factors and the depressive symptom scores. So, that result didn't support the hypothesis. Now, when it comes to the trust in depressive symptoms, and I'll try to explain this table here, the results were a bit interesting and unexpected. So, for example, if you look at, in this fourth column here in the table, those who were very likely to trust a stranger actually had a higher depressive symptoms than those who were not. So you can see this has a positive value here, and it's highly significant. They were actually had worse depressive symptoms, right? And typically, in the literature, people who are trust is associated with better mental health, right? So it was kind of unusual to be having this finding here for trust of strangers. So what I did is I added an interaction, look at, okay, does the effect of an individual's trust depend on the context, right? Does it depend on the level of trust in the district? And what I found was for personalized trust, that seemed to be the case. So for example, when trust in the district was very low, right, people who were very trusting had worse depressive symptoms. So that's represented this positive coefficient here. Then what the interaction effect showed was that as the level of trust in the district increased, then being very trusting became less harmful in terms of depressive symptoms. And I'll try to explain that, with a graph here. So on the left, we have here about trust of neighbors. And so what you can see is when the percent of the district who is very likely to trust their neighbors is essentially zero, those who are very trusting have higher depressive symptoms, worse depressive symptoms than those who are less trusting. Then as the percent of the district that's very likely to trust increases, then being very trusting becomes slightly better for the depressive symptoms, right? For trust of strangers, we didn't really see that interaction. It seemed that people who were very trusting had worse or higher depressive symptoms overall across the board. Now, I think one thing to keep in mind here is that most of the districts in South Africa had very low levels of trust. There weren't really any districts here out here with 60% or 80% of people trusting. You know, this is, a model. So essentially extrapolating what you would expect to find if the pattern was continuing. So it's important to keep that in mind. I think the results here are still interesting. So let me just summarize these findings and see, kind of describe what, interpret them in a way, what the implications are. So just to recap, in the fixed effects models, the changes in income inequality were not significantly associated with the changes in CBD risk factors or depressive symptoms at the individual level for the individuals in the survey. And there's a number of reasons for that that could potentially explain why we didn't find a statistically significant result. One is that all the districts had very high levels of inequality. And it's possible that at such high levels of inequality, maybe the damage has already been done. So having a marginal increase in inequality might not really show or produce much of an effect. So that could be one reason. Another reason could be the time period or the etiologic period, right? So In this study, the inequality was measured 1 or 2 years before the health outcomes were measured, right? And although these were, risk factors like blood pressure, BMI, which can change a bit more quickly, it may be possible that it can take longer to actually observe effects of these changes in inequality. And so I did try to do some sensitivity analyses using earlier censuses, so like 1996 and 2001. And even with that, I still didn't really find significant results. So I don't think that is the explanation. others, limitations in the methodology. So, for example, some people argue that the Gini coefficient isn't may not be the best measure of inequality, right? And there, you can have communities with different distributions of income that end up with the same Gini coefficient. So there might be other measures of inequality that might be better to use. Also the models, fixed effects models, are very conservative models because they're not really modeling all the variation. They're just only modeling the changes and then controlling for so many factors. So it could also be that it's hard to detect differences there. And then finally, it could just mean that there's no causal association between income inequality and these particular outcomes in South Africa. Now, one of the arguments that people who do some of this research on income inequality and health make is that income inequality really, in a way you could say, exacerbates health problems that have a social gradient, right? And so what I mean by the social gradient is, for example, in countries like the UK, where I am now, people who are poorer tend to have higher levels of overweight and obesity. So in that kind of society, perhaps income inequality would make overweight and obesity worse. Now, in a country like South Africa and in many other low and middle income countries, maybe you might see similar in Ghana as well, people who are overweight and obese tend to be, people who are poor tend to be less likely to be overweight and obese, for example. So perhaps that particular outcome that might not be as affected by inequality. And maybe something like undernutrition, right? Or malnourishment. Maybe if you're looking at something like that, where in many countries, those who are poor are more likely to be malnourished, maybe you would find a relationship between income inequality and those types of outcomes. And I did look a bit at underweight, do some sensitivity analyses with that. And it seems that there might be a bit of an association with income inequality and underweight. So perhaps, it could also be that not all health outcomes are impacted in the same way by inequality. So in terms of social capital and trust, just to recap again there, in the fixed effects models, it seemed that those who had lower levels of trust had lower or better depressive symptoms, right? And those with higher levels of trust tended to have higher depressive symptoms. But then there was this interaction, a cross-level interaction between their individual trust and the trust in the district they live. And what results seem to suggest is that, whether your personal trust is beneficial for your mental health might actually depend on the context, on where you live. If you're someone who's very trusting and you're living in a community where nobody trusts each other, you can't trust people, maybe it's actually worse for your mental health. So in the case of South Africa, distrust is very high across the board. So that might mean that people who are very trusting might have worse depressive symptoms. So I'll just end with some strengths and limitations of this research. Of course, some of the limitations are generalizability. Each country might have very different results. So if you're maybe to do a similar study in a place like Ghana, you might see something very different. Also, there were, the people who were lost to follow-up over time, right? It might present some selection bias. There could still always be a chance that there's some confounding factors that weren't measured that might still be affecting the results. And of course, with all, statistical analyses, there's a risk that some of the findings that you find are potentially by chance. Another thing to keep in mind was that although I tried to use the NIDS survey to measure trust at a district level, the survey itself is designed to be representative nationally and at the province level, but not necessarily at the district level. So that might affect the last analysis. And then similarly, there's in the last analysis, there's still also potential for reverse causation because the trust and depressive symptoms were measured in the same survey. There were a number of strengths to this research. So one, that we had objective measures of risk factors for NCDs like blood pressure, waist circumference, body mass index. And for mental health, there was a scale that was in the survey, so we didn't have to rely on whether people had a diagnosis or not. And of course, you know, in especially in the African context, where access to healthcare might not be that high, if you have to rely on whether people have been diagnosed, then you might miss a lot of people. I think another strength is that for the inequality measurements were from the year before people's health outcomes were measured. So that helps us to know that it, this temporal order that happened before was a large sample size. And then the longitudinal data allowed us to use this fixed effects design to really control for confounding. And finally, we had data at multiple levels. So we could really look at this idea of a contextual effect, right? Controlling for people's individual circumstances, does inequality or social capital have an effect on their health? So I'll just end with, you know, a few conclusions and recommendations. You know, although income inequality and many CVD risk factors increased during the period studied in this research, there wasn't really evidence that the changes in inequality were associated with changes in CVD risk factors or depressive symptoms. But nonetheless, there were some interesting findings relating to trust. So, you know, additional research could be could look at some of these issues further, look at other health outcomes, longer time periods, could also try to replicate this interaction that was observed with the social capital or the trust. And finally, qualitative research might also help to shed light on some of these findings. So here are some references here. Also acknowledging you know, my co-authors on this research. So my PhD committee, the funding that supported the research as well, the National Income Dynamics Study and Data First. And yeah, thank you very much. And I'm happy to open it up now for discussion or question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kafi. I mean, this is exceptional. And I'm actually very excited about how you walked us through your methods. So for some of our students, I mean, for most of your work, you've been familiar with cross-sectional data sets. But what I'm actually excited about is how Dr. Kafi walked us through how to use longitudinal data to answer these kinds of questions and even how to use interaction terms and the rest. I mean, it may sound like some math terms to you, but they're actually very simple and very easy to use. So if you have any question, the floor is open. We have 30 minutes that we can engage and ask questions about this research, about her methods, and even how she also applied concept during her conceptual framework. I'm sure you all saw her design and how she was able to, you know, bring in other theories together to actually explain her work. So if you have any questions, I can take them now and she can also take them. You can show your face like I have done if you want to, and then you can ask your question. Thank you. Is anybody coming up?
They're either they understood everything or they understood nothing.
I was actually looking at the income disparities slide the relationship that the income inequality have with stress, mental health, and I just want you to throw a little light on that for us.
Yeah, yes, I can do that. So let me go back to my slides. Okay. So let me just go back here to this slide, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been quite a bit of research done on these issues, mostly in high income countries. And what they find is that, you know, countries that have very high levels of inequality tend to have worse health outcomes and worse social outcomes, right? So you look at, say, a country like Japan that has very low inequality, it's a very equal society. And I'm sure many of you have heard stories about Japan, how, you know, if you lose something, someone will return it to you, all that kind of stuff. Japan is also known to have a very long life expectancy, one of the highest life expectancies in the world. So you can kind of see a bit of how this inequality might be linked to health outcomes, right? You look at the other opposite end, the United States. The United States is one of the most unequal of the high-income countries, right? Now, a lot of low- and middle-income countries have even worse inequality than the USA. But when we're looking just at the group of high-income countries, USA is quite bad in terms of its inequality, right? And we also know that the U.S. has very high levels of, say, crime and violence, right? We hear about mass shootings and things like that. Obesity levels are also quite high when you compare them to countries like Norway, Sweden. Infant mortality, the U.S. has some of the highest infant mortality among high-income countries, right? So essentially what... that's why there's this hypothesis that, you know, social epidemiologists have been interested in, you know, is inequality leading to some of these health problems, right? And so that's, and that's why there's like these hypotheses about, well, inequality might maybe increase stress, right? And stress can lead to health problems. Inequality also reduces people's social capital, right? People don't trust each other as much, right? In countries with less trust, there tends to be higher crime, for example. So so those are some of the things that have so far that have been linked. Again, a lot of the research is from high-income countries, and it also tends to be ecological, right? Where you're looking at the overall health in the population, right? Overall life expectancy, for example, right? But I think one of the things that this type of work shows also, and a lot of social epidemiologists, sociologists, et cetera, try to promote is the importance of having social safety nets, for example, having, maybe redistributing wealth, right? So for example, you see in this, let me use my pointer again. Let's see. So like if you see here at the bottom here, a lot of these Scandinavian countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, come up here in terms of low inequality. And we know that a lot of those countries tend to have very high taxation, right? Where they tax people heavily, maybe half their income, for example, and they use that to provide social services to the population, right? So they have very good parental leave policies, healthcare, and things like that. And so what some of this work suggests is that, you know, in these types of settings, perhaps countries that focus more on having a more equal income distribution and using that money to provide social services, maybe that leads to better health for the population. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it's a very good feedback you've given us. We're just thinking through. We were doing something on epidemiological transitions. And mm-hmm. one of the things that stands out is that Ghana, for instance, is going through a period of protracted polarized transitions, mm-hmm. meaning that there's a double burden of disease, right? Mm-hmm. And we also have issues with, in terms of economic issues, where there's very high income disparity, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at, we're going to this polarized situation with income gaps as well. I was just thinking about it. In some of our readings we did this week, we learned that in Europe, Eastern Europe, it took them about 200 years to go from that transition from a period of receding pandemics to the current chronic situation that they have, right? Mm-hmm. I was wondering in my mind, are we going to take that long to be able to make that progress, looking at what we have here in our settings in the region? Yeah. I don't know if it makes sense to you.
Yeah. No, I do. I do understand your question. And I mean, I think I'll say this from a personal perspective, but also I think in terms of the data that I'm aware of or the research that I'm aware of, I feel like you know, many low and middle income countries are actually going through a faster epidemiologic transition than what we saw in Europe, for example, right? It's occurring in a more compressed period of time, right? And so what we have, like say in South Africa and similar in Ghana as well, is you have this infectious disease, where infectious diseases are still present at the same time where you have the NCDs, right? So, you know, we had like, you know, TB, malaria, you know, HIV, AIDS are still very common in many, you know, low and middle income countries, cholera outbreaks and things like that. But at the same time, you have the diabetes, you have the hypertension. And so I think that suggests that instead of going through this period of, say, first the infectious disease decreases and declines, and then, you know, the NCDs come in, as like now it's almost happening all at once, right? This double burden of disease. And so, some people interpret that to mean that maybe the epidemiologic transition argument, it doesn't really apply everywhere, right? Maybe it doesn't happen in the same way everywhere. And I think that's a valid argument, and that maybe what was the path that, say, the European countries took might not necessarily be the path that other countries are taking, right? So the transition, we have to be critical of a little bit of this idea of transition. It's happening, but it might not be happening the same way everywhere. I don't know, does that kind of address what you were discussing?
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kafri. I think that response was on point. And now also, you know, because of how we have global trade, mm-hmm. and how we are also, like, you know, importing technology and mm-hmm. resources, food and the rest, I mean, it's going to fast track our process. It's not going to take another 200 years like they did, because mm-hmm. for them, it happened alongside industrialization. But mm-hmm. we are actually just importing these things into our country. So we don't have to necessarily go through that same period of time. But I think that for me, it's really about looking at the socio-ecological framework and seeing how structural factors actually influence health outcomes at the community and at the individual level. So even using the income inequality as your measure of structural level variables. So Doc, my question, actually, if nobody has a question, I can ask mine. how reflective of people's life is this income inequality measures?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things with the measures of income inequality is that it looks at things on a large scale, right? For example, so say, you know, if you're looking at it on a national level, right, then you don't really get a sense of the distribution, right? I think one of the things I mentioned is that there might be two different countries where the income is distributed a little bit differently, but then they get the same Gini coefficient, mm-hmm. right? So they're not all the measures really get a sense of the actual distribution. There are there are other different measures that are used. So some people use like a ratio. They compare the top 10% to the bottom 90%, or maybe they compare the top 70% to the bottom 30%, do like a ratio of the share of income in the society. So there are different measures that are used. And, you know, I think maybe some of those measures might be a bit better at getting at the distribution. But as you're saying, like, again, you know, when you put things in numbers, it's helpful because it helps you to quantify things, right? And in epidemiology, we need to quantify things, but then it also leaves out a lot of the experiences, right? And that's where, you know, having qualitative research, for example, can really help to get more information and shed more light on what you're seeing with the numbers. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have a follow-up question. I mean, right now, almost all our students, they've received their ethical clearances and are going to be collecting data. And, you know, definitely are going to ask questions about income and you know, wealth and the rest. Please, what's your advice to them when collecting this data, and what kinds of tools can they actually use?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I think, I mean, income is a tricky measure everywhere, just because one, people aren't always, they don't always feel open about saying how much they earn, right? I think a lot of people feel a bit timid. So like even with, you know, this data in South Africa, if you look at the South African census, you'll see quite a large number of people who have an income of zero, right? And it's not always easy to measure, right? Because people, their income comes from many different sources, not just the earnings that you make, but say if you have relatives who are giving you money, right? That's a source of income, right? Yeah. So if you're receiving benefits, say from the government, that's a source of income. So when it comes to income, I think it's very difficult to measure it accurately. And I think in a lot of low and middle income countries where people maybe don't get a regular salary, for example, they're working in the informal sector too, it becomes hard for people to estimate how much they earn. So a lot of times you'll find that, you know, people prefer using things like wealth to measure socioeconomic status. So looking at assets, right? So for example, I'm sure some of you are familiar with like the Demographic and Health Survey, the DHS. There they tend to measure what are the household assets. Like, do you own a radio? Do you own a TV, X, Y, and Z? And then use that to make a wealth index. And I think a lot of people prefer that, especially in low and middle income settings, that it seems to be easier to get a sense of people's socioeconomic status using that kind of measure. So, you know, in terms of recommendations, I might say consider looking into wealth as well. One of the other benefits of using wealth is that it's more stable, right? People's income can fluctuate a lot, change a lot, right? People who work, say, in agriculture, it's very seasonal. So if you're asking how much they earned in the last month, maybe the last month doesn't represent how much they would have earned the month before or 9 months before, right? So with wealth, it tends to be more stable when you're looking at the assets people own, what they have in their household, toilets, running water, et cetera. So it tends to be a better measure of people's socioeconomic status than income. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ume, your hand is up.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is Patrick. I have actually exchanged communication with you.
Yes.
And I thank you for that wonderful presentation. During your presentation, you mentioned that income inequality has increased in South Africa, even post-apartheid. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, shouldn't that really decrease? So if some thoughts on why that is the case. And then secondly, looking at a slide where you discussed the income inequality and health, cite an example from different countries. I saw that the US was more or less an outlier. The work done by Miguel Cripps, it's titled Turning the World Upside Down. He argued that about 1% of the global supply of health resources are in Africa. Meanwhile, Africa is dealing with 25% of the global disease burden. Mm-hmm. And then in contrast with the US, they argue that the US is dealing with only 1% of the global disease burden with 25% of the resources. Mm-hmm. But then all of that, how come they are still an outlier in that data set? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those questions. Yeah, I mean, with the first one about why income inequality isn't going down in South Africa, I mean, I would say I don't have all the answers, but just from my observations, right, the times that I've been there, it's still a very unequal society. And although apartheid ended, if you go with, it's still very segregated society, right? So there's still very segregated communities where people live, right? You know, people are living in townships. If you go to the townships, it's mostly Black South Africans, colored South Africans. If you go to a place like Cape Town, right, most of the images I had in my slideshow were from South Africa. If you take some, you know, some of the wealthier communities in Cape Town, you know, maybe I'll show, for example, this one. If you go there, in the, sorry, let me share my slides again. So for example, this is a residential community in Cape Town, right? And this kind of community, you won't really find high concentrations of Black South Africans and colored South Africans, right? You'll find high concentrations of white and Asian South Africans, right? So although apartheid ended, you know, I think the inequality persists because one, you know, South Africa is trying to, and Sandra, you might have some insights on this as well, based on your experience. They're trying to do the government is trying to do things to address some of the inequalities. So they have like policies similar to, say, affirmative action in the US, where they're trying to promote hiring, say, Black South Africans in certain positions, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is that it took a long time for South Africa to get the way it did. And I think it's gonna take a long time for it to change, right? Yes. Unless right now you still have land ownership, which is a very unequally distributed. White South Africans still own the majority of the land, for example. So although apartheid ended, it's not like there was much done to reverse the damage that had been done. So the structures are still there. And I think it's similar. You see it similar things in the US, for example, you know, slavery ended, but you still see the same types of inequalities, right? So that's my view on it. I don't know, Sandra, what do you think?
Thank you very much, Kafi. And thank you, Patrick, for this question. So, I mean, I think that this conversation is actually moving us towards a lot more understanding of global health issues. And I'm actually very happy with how we are talking about different countries and different settings. So in South Africa, what I would say is that it's really, it could be due to corruption, because from the agric sector, where I've done a lot of my research on food insecurity, a lot of the interventions, the monies that were supposed to go into the activities, it doesn't go into it. So if the government had a budget of 9,000 or 9 million rands, you would see that in their reports, only 7 or 2 million was given to the respondents or the beneficiaries, but the 7 million went into administrative costs and the rest. So corruption is one key space where a lot of the money is actually going into. In terms of the affirmative action, now they're employing a lot of Black people in high places. But the challenge is that the generation that can actually be employed is our generation, but not that of our mothers and our fathers or even our aunties, because they didn't have the education that gives them the qualification to be employed in those high spaces. Because of how even the apartheid worked, even the education was also stratified, where you have very poor performing schools in the Black townships, and then the white and private schools in the white communities, very expensive that people cannot afford. So your mother is poor, she didn't go to any good school. She's a teller at Checkers or ShopRite and makes about 2,000 Ghana cedis or even less a month. And all of this money goes into rent if she has to pay for rent in a very good space. So the children don't end up going to any good school, but they end up going to like the government schools, which are very low resources. And then the cycle of poverty and inequality continues over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point too. I think, you know, one of the times I was there, you know, they had like this Africa Health Research Institute, and they're really trying to recruit you know, Black South Africans. If you go to a lot of the universities and things, you see that Black South Africans are underrepresented in a lot of the positions, professors, all those things. Yes. You see a very high representation of white South Africans and things like that. As Sandra was mentioning, a lot of it is the education, right? During apartheid, you know, what I've heard is that there was this idea that Black South Africans didn't really need to learn mathematics and things like that because they weren't really going to need it, right? And so if you have generations of people who didn't build those skills. Now those people, they were children back then, now they're the teachers, but they didn't learn the skills to also be able to effectively teach those skills to the next generation, right? So then you have generations of people who don't have the skills to fill some of those positions. So I think that's, Sandra's point is very important. Yeah, and then you asked about, you mentioned about the U.S. being an outlier and kind of this global inequality. And I think I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, like here I was looking at inequality at a national level. But I personally think that these issues extend to a global level as well, right? And kind of what you mentioned about the distribution of resources, say a country like the U.S., in terms of their resources, they only have 1% of the disease burden, right? And then you look at, in many African countries and the high disease burden there as well. And for me, I think a lot of those differences you see between countries also reflect this inequality, right? And it's not, in this case, it's not really maybe inequality of income, but maybe inequality of, I guess, one, there's an economic inequality, there's a power inequality, right? The resources, who uses the resources, where do the resources go? And I think if you were to do this kind of work on a similar scale, right, I personally think having a more equal global society would lead to improvements in health globally, right? Especially in the low and middle income countries. So I think you could extend this idea to a global level. I mean, the US tends to be an outlier when it comes to a lot of things, right? And it comes to homicide and violence when it comes to compared to other high income countries, right? Even when it comes to, the infant mortality, maternal mortality, I think even in spite of that, like say if you were to remove U.S. from this graph, you would still see the same kind of positive relationship. And, you know, I would say that the U.S. is an outlier both in when it comes to inequality and also when it comes to some of these health outcomes. So I think there's still that same relationship there. I don't know if that answers your question.
I appreciate your thoughts in that regard. You know, when I read Turning the World Upside Down by Nigel, you know, it kind of dawned on me that, wow, 25% of the global resources dealing with 1% of it. And then then I'm looking at it and seeing that when it comes to health and social problems, they are also worse with all the resources. You know, it'll be interesting to kind of understand a little bit more. I mean, looking to know how the Americans are thinking about it, where I'm sure they are aware of the resources available to them. And no one deals with data more than them. And then if they are an outlier like this with all the resources, it's certainly a problem someone should look at.
I think so. And I think, if you look at things like life expectancy, you see something similar where life expectancy in the U.S. compared to, you know, other wealthy countries, you know, the Scandinavian countries, Japan, is also lower. And you know, a lot of people argue this about this inequality, right? The U.S. doesn't have a national health insurance, right? For the people who have health insurance, the quality of the healthcare is very good, right? The U.S. has very good quality healthcare, right? But if you are among the millions who don't have health insurance, then you don't have access to that. And so that brings down the whole country in a way, right? So,
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Any question from the class? Any question from Dr. Millicent? I know you are here with us. Oh, we've lost the... Okay. If there are no questions, I would ask that you just put on your camera for 2 minutes and let's all take a picture with Dr. Kafui. So Michael, are you with us? Hello, Michael.
Yes, please, I'm here.
Uh-huh. So Michael can take the picture. So for just like 2 minutes, please put on your camera and let's see you. Victoria, we can't see your face, so just raise your camera a little bit. People are trying to wear their wigs. Dr. Frank, we can't see you. Okay, nice. Okay, all right.
Is it better now, please?
Yes, it's better now. It's better now. Okay. So Michael, you can take, I'm sure the others, I don't know what's, okay, so we have Cletus, Francis, and Helen together. That's nice. Okay. Michael, have you had enough?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. And please have a good afternoon. Kafi, can I ask you to stay for a second?
Yeah.
Thank you. So everybody, please, you can leave the meeting. Thank you very much. Kafi, thank you so much. I mean, this is...
You're welcome.
Please leave the meeting. Please leave the meeting. Thank you. Maxwell is not leaving. Can I take people out?
I think so.
I'm really happy about this because there's a review. I mean, usually you know it's reviewer two who is problematic, mm-hmm. but I have this reviewer one who is making my life impossible.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, let me ask this. Mercy Amma Philip, please can you leave the meeting? Okay, people are leaving slowly, but I mean it's not something that it's bright. To not cause any harm if they listen. So Kafi, I have like two repeated cross sessions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, EduLink. Maxwell, please leave the meeting. Gracia, please leave the meeting. Desmond, please leave the meeting. Thank you very much. Amma, please leave the meeting. Mercy, please leave the meeting. George, please leave the meeting. Michael, can you stop recording?